This episode of War Rocket Ajax is brought to you by Loot Crate. Go to lootcrate.com/warrocketajax and use the offer code WarRocketAjax to get $3 off a brand new subscription.
Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That's War Rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Rocket Ajax, brought to you this week by Noisy Person Cards. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. I have a cold. My name's Chris Sims. Matt, the last time I had a cold, you had a sinus infection. Do you still have a sinus infection?
I do not. I could say okay. I have a fever, but I don't. But you know, you could do the old feed a cold, starve a fever thing. That could be.
I feel like feeding me and starving you is a metaphor for this podcast that's a little too on the nose. That's Matt Wilson. He is the co-host of this show, and we will be your hosts for the next 90-odd minutes of fun and enjoyment.
That's right. We got a lot to get to. Our guest this week is Arthur Wyatt. You've heard him on the show before if you have listened to previous episodes. He is the writer of a series of comics based on the Dread movie, kind of expands that universe a little bit. His newest one is called Dread Dust. We're going to be talking to him about that, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be talking to him about Judge Dread in general for quite a while. That's going to be a fun interview. But first, Chris, let's talk about some of the other stuff that we have going on, some business to start off the show.
Right up front with the business.
That's right. Our listener sponsors, Noisy Person Cards, brought to you by the One Shot Podcast Network.
Now, do you remember maybe a month or two ago when we had Cat Cool and James D'Amato on the show to talk about the campaign podcast? I know you remember at Not Mandalorian. That's where you got your Twitter name.
That's right. Twitter handles have not been popping up for our last few episodes, by the way.
We had a good run of like four in a row.
We did. It worked out really well for a while.
But yes, this is their Kickstarter for Noisy Person Cards, which are designed to help players in RPGs sharpen their voice acting skills for role-playing games. Now, if you've listened to Campaign, if you've listened to One Shot when Matt and I were on, or just because it is a great show, and also Campaign is my favorite thing going on right now, you'll know that they do a lot of in-character voice acting on those shows. You might listen to those shows and think, yeah, of course they're doing some really great in-character voice acting that's awesome and charming and actually fun to listen to. They're improvisers. They've been doing this for a long time. You, too, can learn the skills with these Noisy Person Cards, or NPCs.
They use a very simple mechanic. If you've played Cards Against Humanity or Apples to Apples, you can play this game, the Noisy Person Cards game. So, easy way to invent a new character voice. And these cards aren't just, you know, you don't just have words on them. They are illustrated, and they are illustrated by some comics artists that you may have heard of, including Jess Fink of Chester 5000, at one time a War Rocket Ajax guest. Molly Ostertag of Strong Female Protagonist has done illustrations
for these cards. A great comic.
Yeah, really good. You don't even have to donate to the Kickstarter to be able to see what these cards look like, okay? If you want to make up your mind about donating to the Kickstarter, if you go to their Kickstarter page right now, you can get a link to a free 150-card print-and-play sample of the game before you buy the whole thing, which is a really cool thing that they're doing it, that they do not have to do it all. They're giving away a piece of this.
They certainly don't have to do 150 cards. They could have done it with 10.
Yeah.
But no, they're giving you 150 to print out and play before you even think about backing the Kickstarter. But I'm going to tell you, you should absolutely back this Kickstarter. Kat and James and the One Shot Podcast and Campaign are fantastic. They're absolutely worth your time. They are friends of this show, and they are genuine friends of mine and Matt's. So head over to their Kickstarter. We'll have a link on warrocketajax.com, and you can go check that out. They are awesome, and this is a great project.
And if you don't go to warrocketajax.com, what is wrong with you? But if you don't go there, if you just download the show from iTunes and that is all you do, all you have to do is do a Google search for Kickstarter Noisy Person Cards, and it will pop right up for you. This is something you're going to want to get in on. If you play our tabletop RPGs, if you just are into voice acting and you want to practice different voices, different characters, these are really cool resources for that. So go check that out. Go donate to that Kickstarter. It'll be well worth it. All right, Chris. Those are our sponsors. Now it's time for us to thank our newest supporters on Patreon.
People are loving to give us money this week, Matt, and I love that about the people, and I love that about us, and I love it about you.
Thank you. I think that's something I should thank you for. All right, here are our newest supporters.
You're welcome.
Here are our newest supporters on Patreon. They're helping us keep paying those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail call bills. Stuart Wilson.
Oh, thank you, Stuart. Hey, that's your last name.
That's my last name. James Rosario.
Oh, thank you, James.
And that's it for this week. Those are our newest supporters on Patreon. Thank you to them. Thank you for everyone who supports us on Patreon. You are the people that keep this show going. Help us pay all the bills we have to pay. Keep up with all the stuff we have to keep up with. You help us give you rewards. I am in the process of sending out even more t-shirts this week. T-shirts are going out to people.
I had forgotten about our new shirts until I saw them, until a listener, Emma, tweeted us a picture. And she, like, I had completely forgotten what the new shirts were. They're awesome. They look really great.
They're really good. They're really good shirts. And I was wearing one the other day. I think the design is amazing for them. They were designed by Jay Gonzo, who also designed the Shaw Brothers Movie Fighters logo.
And who is the next artist to do a backer exclusive piece of art. And it's pretty awesome. I gotta say, I've seen it already. I don't think it's quite finished yet, but it's going to be pretty great.
So that's just a sampling of some of the stuff you can get if you help us out on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/warrocketajax and help us out if you like. If you don't, you'll still get the show for free every single week, like you always do. That will not change, and we appreciate you for listening, whether you back us on Patreon or not. All right, Chris, enough of the salesy portion of the show. Let's get to checks and wrecks. So come on and diggity-check yourself before you wreck yourself. All right, Chris, what are you checking in with this week?
Well, Matt, I'm sick. I have a cold again. I think Aiden picked up a cold while we were traveling. And then, of course, now it is within me. And there it will stay. It's not the worst cold I've ever had, but it is like I am at a constant 4 out of 10 for discomfort, which makes it very hard to focus on anything.
Uh-huh.
So all I have done this week, literally all I have done, I have not left the apartment in 4 days. I have done work, and I have played Axiom Verge, and that's it.
Is that the entirety of the check? Do you have something?
That's the entirety of the check. Like I got nothing. I mean, look, I'm doing a sleep study on Sunday night to find out if I have sleep apnea, but that has not happened yet. By the time you listen to this, it will have happened, but I got nothing. I have been very sick.
All right. Well, let me say from me to you, and let me speak on behalf of all our listeners and say, Chris, get well soon.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to drink some tea while you tell me what you're checking in with this week, Matt.
I've been doing book update for the past several weeks because that is really the majority of what I've been spending all my time doing. Any free moment I have, more or less, has been spent sitting in front of my computer writing more of this book. And just on a whim, because I felt like it was time to let the cat out of the bag, because I can't just keep talking about this vague book anymore, I gave the title of the book on Twitter, So the title of the book, at least as it is now, the working title, is Supreme Villainy, The Life and Deaths, plural, of King Oblivion PhD. It's a memoir. That's all I'm going to give away right now. A fake memoir. It's, as I said on Twitter, it's not my memoir. It would be a weird title to give my memoir.
No, it wouldn't, Matt. You have died several times.
That's right. That is the title. It's a fake memoir. Hopefully people will think it's really funny. But I just decided, you know what? Time to give the title on Twitter. So I did. That is out there in the ether. It is supposed to be coming out sometime next year, I think next summer. It's about a year from now, plus maybe an extra month or two is when the book's going to be coming out. I am making what I think is pretty good progress on it, and I hope people are excited about it. I hope the folks who liked the first two books will like this one. It is very different from those two. It is not structured like a how-to. There's a story to this one. That goes beyond the very slim through line of the first two books. So I'm proud of my work so far. Hopefully people will like it once I finally get this thing finished. All right, Chris, those are our checks. Let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend?
Well, Matt, we have a little bit of a shared check that we could do. Even though we talked about it a little bit on the on the Every Story Ever special, that was definitely from April.
Yeah, I mean, that was, we recorded it and posted it in April.
So many weeks ago that we recorded that and posted it. But I did want to give, if people missed that, special shout out to Lucas Brown, who sent us each a gigantic box of snacks from Australia.
Yes, that's right. I have it in my office. It's right over here next to me. I have been nibbling on the various snacks in the box, but I've been keeping some of them unopened or at least not fully eaten so that we can talk about all the contents of the snack boxes once we record another episode of Movie Fighters. I don't know when that's going to be. People have been asking me on Twitter, when's the next Movie Fighters coming out? The answer is I don't know, because Chris, you were gone. Then I'm going to be gone this coming weekend. Not this coming weekend, but next weekend. I will probably not be around to record Ajax that week. So Chris, you get a solo with a guest host episode to compliment mine.
I've never done one of those before. I think I did.
You have.
I did it with Kieran.
I keep forgetting. I think you've done one with Elle, too.
Did I do one by myself with Elle? I probably did.
Anyway, the next time we do a Movie Fighters, we are just going to run through all the contents of our Aussie snack box and really give special thanks to Lucas. But he deserves thanks right now for going to the trouble to send us these huge boxes of Australian snacks.
These are like shoebox sized boxes. There are three kinds of Tim Tams in my box.
Yeah, I think
which I'm
both
very, very excited about.
We compared and contrasted. I think we both got the same three varieties of Tim Tams.
I'm so excited.
And what are Tim Tams? Listen to you whenever we do our next Movie Fighters to find out. I think we're gonna have to do an all Australian episode of Movie Fighters to celebrate this.
Well, I better get some Noisy Person cards and work on my Australian accent.
Yes, that is a good plan. All right.
Ching.
Let's make some recommendations, Chris. What do you have to recommend?
All right. We've done a lot of ads on this show already. This is going to sound like an ad. It is not. although it is kind of, essentially. I think I mentioned on the show a while back, it might have been my rec already, in fact, that for Valentine's Day, Aiden got me a Trunk Club subscription. If you've listened to a podcast, you have more than likely heard an ad for Trunk Club on something. If you've listened to any of the Earwolf brand programs, I'm sure you've heard it. But Trunk Club is pretty great. It's basically, there is a person. Her name is Stacy. When Aiden signed me up, she answered a lot of questions about what kind of clothes I prefer. And then Stacy picks out some clothes, and every now and then she'll send me a big box of them. I have gotten some pants. I've gotten a couple shirts, some collar stays, some socks. It's all really, really awesome stuff, and I like it a lot. And here's the reason I'm bringing it up now. It is a genuinely really cool thing for someone like me who I don't super enjoy going clothing shopping for myself, unless I am buying clothing that I am going to wear to punch school. So getting a big box of clothes that someone who is familiar with my style and that who will listen to me when I say, yeah, I liked this, but I didn't like this, is a really fun thing for me. In case you haven't been able to tell, I love getting things in the mail. That is not an invitation for people to send me things. but I do love getting things in the mail, and I love getting like presents in the mail, even if they are presents from myself. So Trunk Club has been great. Like, if you see me at any signings or conventions this summer, like, odds are pretty good that I am going to be wearing at least one item from Trunk Club. So I bring this up now because they do have, like so many businesses of this kind, they do have a referral link. And I have one. This will take you to Stacy, who is my stylist. And here's the deal. You can go and check it out. If any of you sign up and you spend $50, I get $50 in credit for each one of you who signs up. Now, here's the thing. Trunk Club gets a little expensive. I literally spent $400 on pants, and that is my clothing purchase for the year. You know, I would be super thrilled if a couple of you out there signed up and I get to buy more pants, because Lord knows I need them. But it's real easy. It's, I think we're going to put this on the site if we can, but it's trunkclub.com/invite/X66KYU. Write that down. Go to that. That'll take you to Stacy. She gets referrals. I get referral credit. You get to have someone pick out clothes for you and send them to you. They have men's clothes, women's clothes. It's all good stuff. So maybe check that out. That is my recommendation. And it honestly, I would not be talking about it if it was not a service that I had used and enjoyed. Also, Stacy's really nice. She's like super nice. So definitely check that out. Matt, what's your rec this week?
My rec is a movie that I had been wanting to see for quite a while, but had not gotten around to seeing yet until this weekend when I went over to the old Redbox and got it.
The old Redbox?
You're going down the old Redbox?
You better watch out, man. That Redbox is haunted.
That Redbox will jump up and bite you. what I got was Crimson Peak, which is not the movie it was advertised to be. It was advertised to be a spooky ghost movie.
Yeah, guess why I did not see it.
Yeah, directed by Guillermo del Toro. And there are ghosts in it, but it's not a spooky ghost movie. I don't even know if I super want to give away everything about it, because if there's one thing about the movie that benefits from it being marketed as like an entirely different movie than what it really was, it's that the movie that you see when you watch it is unexpected. It's a surprise. It hasn't all been given away yet. I saw a lot of user reviews like on IMDb and places of the movie that say it's predictable, which I guess is somewhat true. Like, once you see where the movie is going, you can kind of figure it out. Like, what Tom Hiddleston's whole deal is, and what some of the other characters' whole deals are. But that kind of ultimately doesn't matter, because the movie is so much about, like, telling that story in a very, very stylistically beautiful, visually appealing way. This is a movie about set design and costumes and atmosphere and a giant house that's sinking into red clay. So it looks like the floor is bleeding. Like, there's red clay coming out of the walls. And ultimately, it's a movie about Tom Hiddleston just having a business plan and wanting to execute that business plan somehow. I kind of really got sucked in by the visuals of it. I think all the acting is really good. Tom Hiddleston has a sister character who's played by Jessica Chastain, who is so good in this. Like, she absolutely nails her role so perfectly. And I feel like this movie was really unfairly maligned, to be honest. Like, I think it's because people went in and got a movie that they weren't expecting it to be. And possibly if I had gone to see it at the movie theater in October during Halloween movie times, I maybe wouldn't have had as positive a reaction as I did. But seeing it as I did, I ended up loving this movie a lot. So see Crimson Peak if you have any interest at all in a Guillermo del Toro movie with some ghosts, but that's really about other stuff. It's been described as a gothic romance, which is partially true, but it's a gothic story. It almost ends up being kind of a gothic crime story. So if that sounds enjoyable to you, check that movie out. I liked it a whole bunch.
So you're saying it is not scary? Like, you think I can watch it and not be scared?
It is not scary. Let me give a bit of a spoiler warning here and say that the ghosts in the movie, as they appear, are not malevolent figures whatsoever. They are friendly. They are helpful ghosts.
Okay, well, generally, like, historically speaking, I also hate friendly ghosts, just not in a scary way.
Okay, well, I your mileage may vary about whether or not you like the friendly ghosts, but they are only typically there to help anytime they appear. So take that as you will. I really liked it and thought it was a very good movie. All right, that's it for our recommendations. Let's move into talking about some comics.
Alrighty.
All right, I think we should probably start with The Punisher number one, the new series from writer Becky Cloonan, who I think is a really interesting and inspired choice to write a Punisher series, and someone who is very familiar to people who have read Punisher comics as an artist, Steve Dillon. I thought that this was a strong first issue. In some ways, it kind of follows that Garth Ennis Punisher mold a little bit. It, you know, it sets up, here are some people that need to die who are doing terrible, terrible things. And here's the Punisher, this kind of almost supernatural force who is there to make sure that they are all killed. And it's even down to, you know, the Punisher not really being a character per se in this issue. He barely has any lines of dialogue. I think he maybe has a couple, but for the most part, it's just criminals talking about him like he's this legendary figure. One twist, though, that I think makes this issue really, really interesting and almost is kind of a winky nod to people who loved the Ennis run on Punisher, is there's this character named Olaf who works for the criminal organization and has a background as a Marine and apparently seemingly has a history with Frank Castle. He says at one point that he was Frank Castle's commanding officer, but who looks exactly like Garth Ennis's Punisher, but with blonde hair. It looks exactly like the way Steve Dillon would draw Frank Castle in the Garth Ennis Punisher stories, where he's this, you know, the older guy. He's got the, like, the eyebrows and the kind of squinty eyes, even down to the haircut. He looks kind of like Frank Castle. So it's almost like this alternate version of Frank Castle is passing on the character torch to this newer version with a shorter haircut who is clearly younger and, you know, probably served in Afghanistan or whatever. So I think there's a lot to be really interested in. Also, there is a character named Face who is kind of one of those instant, like, oh yeah, this sadist Frank Castle is absolutely going to kill. Who is seen throughout the issue and is just instantly hateable. It's pretty great. I really liked this first issue of this new Punisher series. It pushes my buttons.
I was honestly like just too out of it on cold medicine to read new comics this week, but I am absolutely looking forward to reading this one. I'm, you know, obviously a huge Punisher fan, obviously a huge Steve Dillon fan, but I'm also a huge, huge Becky Cloonan fan. And I really can't wait to read this book and see what she does.
I think you'll like it, Chris. I think you will. The next comic I want to talk about quickly is Midnighter number 12, which I believe is the last issue of the series, which has been so good as it's been going. Steve Orlando has written it throughout and has done a great job kind of pulling a story, you know, a complete story together in these 12 issues. The artist is ACO, I'm sorry. And also Hugo Petras does some of the art in this one. I think ACO has been the main artist throughout the series, though. And this issue kind of pulls together everything that's been building since, you know, really since issue one. You know, a couple issues ago, we found out that Henry Bendix is behind a lot of this stuff that's been happening to Midnighter throughout the series, and that he's created this sort of synthesized superhero named the Unified, who not only can predict everything just like Midnighter can with a computer brain, but who also has like the powers of Apollo. And this final issue of this Midnighter series reunites Midnighter and Apollo in a really satisfying way. First as a, you know, a superhero team, as sort of a superhero unit of two superheroes working together. And then also eventually maybe as a couple, even though it's kind of left up in the air a little bit. What's great about that is like, it's not the same Apollo, you know, who used to be in the Authority. This is kind of an updated version of Apollo, just like this is an updated version of Midnighter. And it doesn't feel like either version of either character is really regressing. It feels like they're progressing together, which I think is very indicative of what this Midnight series has been. A lot of forward-thinking ideas. And in that regard, it has been a series that has worked really well. It's one of a handful of DC books that is going to be ending going into DC Rebirth that, you know, I'm going to mourn. This and Omega Men and a handful of other books, you know, I will wish had stuck around into DC Rebirth. But at least we got these 12 issues, you know? At least these 12 issues were really good.
Yeah, and I genuinely feel like books like Midnighter, Omega Men right now, you know, Batgirl, Black Canary, Gotham Academy, obviously.
Grayson.
Like, those are the books that we're going to look back on in a couple of years, the way we look back on stuff like Hourman and Chase and, you know, like, even something like Starman or Hitman, where it's like, yeah, that was it. That was when everything was kind of firing on all cylinders, sort of the end of the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s. That's how we're going to look back on those books. And they're really, really good. Midnighter is amazing, and I believe Steve Orlando does have a book in the post Rebirth stuff, and I'm really excited about seeing what he does next because Midnighter was great, and I wish Midnighter was continuing. But I would love to see more from him that's as fun and innovative and surprising as what he's already put out.
Yeah, I really think that like late 2014, like basically DCU, right? Uh-huh. Like like 2014 through 2015 and then into 2016 is going to be a time that we're going to look back on DC Comics and be like, wow, they were doing some great stuff.
Yeah, 2015 is the new 1998.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Just to wrap up real quick, I want to talk about Moon Knight number 2 by Jeff Lemire and Greg Smallwood. I talked about the first issue, so I'm not going to dig into this too much more because number 2 is very much a continuation of what was happening in number 1. But, man, the art in this book is so good. Greg Smallwood is so good. And you know, Jordy Belair's colors add so much to it. Like, there's a few sequences in here where there's a very, very limited color palette. And then you get to there's a page turn. And then on that page turn, there's still the limited color palette, but then in sort of a skyscape, these splashes of all these different colors. And it immediately is evocative, you know, of an emotion, of a feeling, of feeling like, you know, there's something further outside of what, you know, Moon Knight is experiencing at that moment. Mm-hmm. It's all so well done. And then, Chris, if I can spoil the end of the issue for you, they get attacked by mummies coming out of subway cars.
Yeah, that sounds exactly like what I'm into.
Like, you know, it's Moon Knight and his crew of people leaving the insane asylum where they've been trapped. They finally get out into a subway station and mummies just come walking out. And I'm just like, yes, this is a book that I like a lot. This is a comic I enjoy.
No matter, are they called his crew in the book, and can they be called the Crew Knight?
They're not called the crew. That is a term I sort of divide now, just now, but I'm sure we could possibly, you know, lobby Jeff Lemire and Greg Smallwood to try to make that happen.
I'm only in charge of Moon Knight 92, if and when.
Okay.
So
Let's start a change.org petition to make that happen.
Sounds good. Sounds like we should definitely do that.
All right. Chris, those are our comics reviews for this week. Now it is time to get into our interview segment with Arthur Wyatt. But before we do that, we should talk a little bit about the May Loot Crate, which has been revealed.
Now, the last time we talked to everybody, the Loot Crate had not been revealed. This Loot Crate was being led to the ring under a blanket.
That's right. But now we can let it be known that the theme of the May Loot Crate is power. What's that? No one crate should have all that power? Oh, no, no. This is one powerful crate. With the release of Captain America Civil War, it is a great time to look at powers clashing one another. And that's why this month's Loot Crate has tons of Marvel stuff to celebrate Captain America Civil War, Warcraft stuff, Dragon Ball Z stuff. There's a lot of really, really cool stuff in this May Loot Crate. It may be too powerful for you to handle, but if you think you can, then for less than $20 a month, you can go sign up for a Loot Crate. As long as you do it by the 19th of May at 9 p.m. Pacific, you will get this very, very cool Loot Crate that includes all that stuff that I just talked about, exclusive items, and a t-shirt, because we don't want to keep you away from that t-shirt that you deserve.
Now, here's what I love about Loot Crate. It's a mystery. We don't know what we're getting. We do not know the contents of the box. But Loot Crate's not just going to say, hey, we're not going to tell you what's in this box. They're going to give you some clues. Matt, you know I love clues. You know I want to follow clues and solve a mystery more than anything in my life. But I have never had the opportunity because I'm very impatient. So Loot Crate, they say, hey, we've got something you can carry. Something for your kitchen and a cool figure. Now that third clue, very easy to figure out. It's going to be an action figure. It's going to be something cool. But something you can carry and something for your kitchen. Those are clues that you can follow. And then if you can't figure out what it is, you just need to get the loot crate and it'll just show up at your house. And you can be like, ah, yes, I suspected it would be this.
And if you're worried that it sounds like, you know, not knowing what's in the box is going to mean that you're going to get some, you're going to get cheaped out, right? Like you're not going to get stuff that's of the value that you expect. Go to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax and look at previous loot crates to see what they've sent people in the past. You can see all the cool stuff that is in those crates and see that you will get your money's worth if you sign up for a loot crate right now. Go to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax, use the offer code WarRocketAjax, and you can even get $3 off a brand new subscription. Get that May loot crate for $3 cheaper than you would anyway. That sounds like a pretty good deal to me. Go do all that stuff right now. Get that loot crate. You will not be sorry. Chris, let's get to our interview with Arthur Wyatt.
That sounds fun. Joining us for the program this week, we are pleased to welcome back, I would say, just based on sheer number of appearances, you are War Rocket Ajax's favorite Judge Dredd creator. John Wagner, I never been on the show. Carlos Izquierdo, never been on the show. Pat Mills will not return my calls. This is your third time. Arthur Wyatt, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, thank you. Well, you know, someday you're going to pierce that time barrier, and then it's all going to come flooding in, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I would love to have Pat Mills here on the show, but I would only ask him questions about his work on the 2099 books, because those are the ones that are fascinating to me.
They're very Pat Mills, so they're inherently fascinating.
That's the thing people don't know, is that Pat Mills and Tony Skinner were the co-writers with Stan Lee on Ravage 2099.
Yeah, it's totally, I mean, if you look at that and leaping straight in with the deep cuts, but I think around about that time he was doing Toxic, and if you look at his average strip on Toxic, which was a sort of short-lived British creator-owned anthology, kind of the same. They're very much the same themes and same style and all of that. Then he went on to write, I think he wrote some, he wrote Accident Man with Tony Skinner. He wrote a bunch of ABC Warriors, I think, with Tony Skinner as well, and that's kind of got a similar story.
Well, that,
more robots. So.
That leads me to something that I want to jump right in with. We will get to talking about your book in a minute, but there's something interesting that I had a conversation with Jay Edidin when I was in Portland, and they were talking about how one of the good things to do if you find yourself overwhelmed by conventions, because you know, I'm sure you do a lot of cons. You're based out of the Seattle area. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I do Emerald City every year. I try to get down to Portland occasionally if I'm very lucky, I get over to New York. I haven't done San Diego yet. That's kind of the Everest.
Yeah, it has a similar mortality rate, I believe.
It has a pile of frozen bodies around its base, and you need oxygen to get up there.
But, you know, Emerald City is a big show. New York's getting huge. I haven't been to New York for the past couple of years, but it is... it was big last time I went, and I've heard it's only gotten bigger. It is rivaling San Diego in terms of attendance. So we do these cons, and Jay told me that one of the best ways to kind of get, you know, make sure you get away from the table, make sure you get a break and kind of come to your senses, is to have a book that you only collect at conventions. Like, pick a run that's long enough where it's going to take you a while, but not expensive. So you're going to be looking for a run of dollar books. And this is a piece of advice that I love, because look, that's what I'm doing at conventions anyway. But my book for that, you know, my let's take a walk and go look at back issues book right now is Doom 2099. I'm trying to put together a run.
Oh, I have not read that one. That's sort of, so I was sort of on the Punisher and Ravage, but I did not get that one. I've heard good things about it, so for a value of good, 2099 good.
Exactly. Weird, I think, is what you hear about.
It's a particular kind of good that you know, if you're into it, you will be into.
So my question for you, Arthur Wyatt, is, do you have any of those titles? Do you have titles that you only look for at conventions, the ones that you're kind of back issue diving for?
And that's interesting. I don't really tend to do much back issue conventions. So I had only, I've only once or twice done a convention where I've been at a table, and I've been pretty rushed off my feet when I've done that. Most of the time, I kind of hit the convention, wander the floor, look for people I've heard of. My sort of thing that I pick up at conventions a bit more is actually interesting-looking books for the kids. So I've got a five-year-old and a nearly 10-year-old. And it turns out to be a very good way of sort of finding out what's going on in that world of comics, is they don't get foregrounded quite so much at the store. I always end up picking up a bunch of stuff at them.
Yeah, I see a lot of kids' books that are really great fun at the convention, which is sort of the opposite of what I write, but I think that's kind of nice.
Is there anything that sticks out that you picked up recently? Because that's interesting. Like, we rarely get to talk to people about like all ages comics and kids' books that they are buying for others.
I picked up a bunch of Lumberjanes last con I was at, and some My Little Pony bits and pieces. My Little Pony's been sort of a running theme with both of them for a couple of years now. Like, how long has that comic been running? I'd say 3 or 4 years, and that's been a perennial favorite.
That is do you leave them on your table so when people are coming up being like, hey, can you sign Dread, and you've just got like My Little Pony sitting there? Because I would immediately, like, I would see that on the table and immediately I'm thinking, crossover. Arthur's doing the My Little Pony Judge Dread crossover. It's happening, finally.
I've talked about the hypothetical crossover possibilities with Douglas Walk a couple of times. I don't think we've really kind of hit on the formula for it. But, it would be fun to do. I suspect Hasbro would be the the sticking point there.
You think 2008 would be all for it? But
I think they'd be pretty down for it. You'd want to keep the respective tone and characteristics of both comic strips as they are normally, but find a way to combine them to end in a horrible bloodbath.
Well, look, I think we can all agree that if there's one thing Judge Dredd needs to learn about, it's the magic of friendship.
Yeah, he's learned a little of that. I guess the Dredd movie, I guess at the end, he's sort of learned to appreciate that not shooting people can be as fun as shooting them.
Not shooting people can be as fun as... Or shooting people can be as fun as throwing them face first through windows, is what he learns in that movie.
Anderson has taught him the value of friendship.
So I don't think we've actually mentioned it. You've got a new Dread story that I believe is out this week, right? Starts this week?
This week, yeah. So May 11th, I guess, would be Wednesday, yeah?
This is your third movie Dread sort of sequel comic?
It's sort of part of a series of movie, I guess, kind of sequels, the continuation. I always sort of feel odd describing them as the sequel because there's always the possibility of a sequel or a Netflix series or a whatever kind of hanging over them. But right now it feels like this is it. This is the thing you want to get if you want more of that world. And it's basically taking the approach of if that world continued and if it was that Netflix-style series, what kind of thing would happen in it? So it's very much in the style of the movie. It's got more of the sort of grit of the Dread world and less of the wacky aliens. But it kind of expands the movie and takes from the comics a little in a sort of almost a Marvel Ultimate style. And yeah, that's basically the goal of the thing, to expand on that version of Dread.
So, not to be, like, entirely joking, but when you approach, like, writing, you know, movie Dread, versus Comics Dread. You know, versus, you know, stone-faced 80-year-old 2000 AD Dread. Like, are there personality differences? Like, is he friendlier?
I mean, Dread, the Dread of the comics at the moment is definitely a lot older, and he's been through a lot of stuff, and he's changed a little, and not exactly softened all the way, but you know, there's a little bit less of an edge to him. Whereas we're dealing with like young Dread of the 1977 comics Dread, really. He's sort of younger, a little keener, a little sort of stiffer on the law. So there is definitely a personality difference there. I mean, weirdly, it's not a big difference in terms of who the character is. It's more of a difference in terms of, you know, the chronology of the character.
Now, does this Dread have a cat? Like, is that something people are imagining? Or is that something
Is the cat. I threw him out earlier, and now he's back in. So he is a tenacious cat. He's going to go on a little journey outside again.
Almost didn't acknowledge it, but I didn't want people listening to this, like, if they're on a run or something, to be, like, looking around, being worried they were about to get assaulted by cats.
So this podcast is mostly about My Little Pony and cats.
So far, so good.
Kittens and puppies.
So you've confirmed that Dredd will be a kitty cat in the world of the My Little Pony Judge Dredd crossover. Go ahead and run with that as the headline.
Yeah. Yeah. He's going to be a cat. Anderson's going to be a puppy. It's going to be very adorable. It's been done in a sort of very kawaii style with big eyes on everyone. Dredd will just have a big visor because he doesn't really do eyes. But
Do you think this is the first time the word kawaii has been used to apply to Judge Dredd?
I don't know. I mean, Dredd's had a lot of riders, so
That's true.
It's hard to say.
Now, the latest story, the one that's coming out, Matt and I got to read it in advance. You were nice enough to provide it. It is called Dust. This is, unless I miss something, and I have read everything you've written for the movie Dread continuations, this is the first time we're getting to see the sort of movie universe version of The Cursed Earth.
Yeah, they go out there.
And so you know what I have to ask. Like, I have to ask it. Is Judge Dredd going to fight, like, a more realistic, sort of grittier movie version of Ronald McDonald at any point?
He is not. He's will encounter a character who's actually a hyper obscure Pat Mills character from the Cursed Earth comic, and no one has called me on that whatsoever, which has been a little disappointing so far. But maybe someone will.
See, that's like I was actually really surprised when I found out that you were going to do this because you know the Cursed Earth is it's a big part of Dredd. It's a big part of the mythology and the stories. But whenever you see it, and this is, you know, I am by no means the comprehensive Judge Dredd fan that you are. Like you will rattle off obscure characters all night long if we ask. But it seems like that's where the book gets weird a lot.
It gets
weirder than normal, I guess I should say.
It gets stranger. I mean, there's this sort of big, weird city with all these strange things going on that sort of New York piled on top of every other city on the eastern seaboard and then sort of magnified through a lens of weirdness. And then you've got to have something outside of that that's so weird and so tough that people want to stay in the city. So that's the challenge of the Cursed Earth, is it has to be a tough, tough place.
So how do you approach that? Well, like where do you start and do you scale back? Do you try and start with looking at other things and try and move it forward so that it still feels like Judge Dredd? How do you approach it?
Well, I mean, I had a nice thing in that there was a character I wanted to use from the previous story, Judge Conte, who's sort of a less senior judge who's sort of following Dredd around after the last story he was on. And she's not been out to the cursed earth before. So we get to see her go out there and be weirded out by the sort of vastness and expanse of this place, which I sort of based that a little on the first time I came to America, actually. Well, I landed in Seattle, which is very nice and green, and I was here for about, I think, a night and a morning before we had to go off to the Tri-Cities, which are in eastern Washington. And at the same time, I was jet lagged and I had this horrible cold, so I ended up taking some unfamiliar American Sudafed medicine that turned out to be particularly strong and weird. So we were driving out into eastern Washington, and I was basically hallucinating at that point. And we came down out of the nice green mountains, and we started driving across central Washington. And that's basically a desert. There's a lot of rocky outcrops and dust and sort of very nasty grass, but not a lot else. And so it was like we'd landed on Mars, and I was sort of looking out on this vast expanse that went all the way to the horizon. And when you're in England, you kind of know the end of the horizon. There's not that much beyond it. There's like a little further to go and you'll hit the sea again. But here, it just like the landscape just keeps on going onto the horizon, and it's kind of mind-blowing. So transposing that to someone who sort of spent their entire life in this sort of rather grey city with a big wall on one side keeping everything out and a polluted sea on the other, and trying to imagine their freaked outness of getting out of that but into something bigger and stranger was a helpful guide in writing that.
See, that is genuinely hilarious to me, because I would have thought that the thing that would prepare you for coming to America would be the Megacity One stuff. Like, it's the, like, because that's basically what we're like. It's just a little more.
Well, on the coast, middle of the country is a whole different deal.
Well, that's true. That's true. Like, have you, like, did you explore further into America and find that the middle of the country lived up to being like those weird parts?
I've got to go on the big traditional Pee Wee Herman style road trip sometime and discover America. My wife, she's American. Her dad used to take her out on sort of trips to see dams and natural wonders and all that stuff all the time when she was a kid. So she has less interest in doing that than me, because she's seen it all. But someday we're gonna do that. We're gonna go to Death Valley and all of that.
Well, listen, this is the. I'm not trying to set your summer plans for you, but this is the year to do it. It's the centennial of the National Park Service.
Yeah, I'm gonna go drive through a big tree with a hole in the middle. That's got to be the way to celebrate that.
I love the idea of you, like, on cold medicine, experiencing the cursor.
Well,
that is great.
When we got to the Tri-Cities, it got better, because there are all these perfectly manicured lawns in the middle of nowhere. So it kind of felt like we were on Mars, and they should have domes over them to keep the atmosphere in.
So, is the cursor something you've always wanted to do? Because, I mean, people can tell from your previous appearances and even from this one already, like, you are someone who has been a Judge Dredd fan for quite a while before you got to working on it. But, you know, I have to imagine.
I mean, I think there's certain touchstones the movie Dredd has to has to hit. And I think the Kerr stuff is definitely one of them. I mean, the movie starts with this sort of immense pan over the Kerr stuff with the city on the horizon. And so it's always been out there as a part of the setting. And this is just a trip out into it to see what's going on. And we get to have some sort of nice things like the horrendous dust storm at the start of the first story. I was particularly happy with the art on that, because it looks like this immense wall of death just rolling in from the wilderness.
You know, at this point, you're the guy. You know, you're the Arthur Wyatt, the movie dread guy, the guy who does the movie dread stories that everybody likes. Like, do you have a list of things? Are you like, okay, if we're continuing this universe, this is what it needs to do in order to be Judge Dredd?
I mean, I think it's a fine balance. You can't just go piling in with all the things that are in the Dredd universe right now, because then it starts becoming regular Dredd and not movie Dredd, and he's just in a different uniform. And I think the movie's approach, where it was quite restrained and it just sort of brought in one or two little things. So, you know, it's science fictional elements are basically the big tower blocks in response to sort of war and environmental collapse, the social collapse, which is sort of a very sort of soft sci-fi element, and then students with psychic powers. So it's like a very restrained set of elements it's dealing with there. I've just been sort of ratcheting them up with, you know, little additions to that I feel like can get away with. I kind of almost imagined that with each one that you're sort of watching, you know, the new season of the show, and there's some new thing that creeps into it, and you're sort of saying, aha, they're bringing in this at last. They're going to have robots or whatever.
I really want there to be robots now. Like, that is an interesting approach. And, like, how do you keep it from feeling too much like a comic strip? Because this is something that I think I'm running into as well in the stuff that I write, is that when you're writing this, you know, alternate version of something, you do have to you have to do what people want to see. You know, as a little more than casual Dredd fan, you know, I'm pretty hard into Dredd, but I only got there a couple of years ago, so. You know, I want to see movie Dredd and the Cursed Earth. I want to see him deal with, you know, like, obviously, I want to see him fight the Dark Judges, because I want to see those outfits. Like, I want to see a Judge Death in the movie Dredd costume, because I think that is hilarious. But, you know, there's an expectation that I'm bringing to that book as a fan, but I don't want it to feel, you know, exactly as you said, I don't want it to feel just like I'm reading the next issue of 2000 AD, because I could be doing that. Like, I could also...
I think if you just plonked in the Dark Judges exactly as is, they'd feel like a huge tonal shift in a way they don't do in the comics. They're sort of these they're these horrifying undead creatures, but there's a real over the top gothic element to them. You know, they've got sort of bones and they've got costumes and themes which doesn't really feel like a movie Dredd thing quite yet. So you'd probably want to step a bit back from that, but you'd want to make it worthwhile them being there and being the Dark Judges. So those guys, they're quite a challenge. I'm sort of thinking about that a little at the moment.
The question I was asking is, when you're writing, you know, a character that you obviously know so well, world that you're obviously super familiar with, and a world that you want to appeal to fans of, then how do you, like, is there something that you've written you've had to go like, no, that's comic Dredd. Like, I got to pull back from this.
I mean, I think I almost have to imagine a show budget for it and imagine what I'd see in a show that was based on some property I loved, I'd say, yes, they've totally nailed that in a version that works for that, and sort of imagine them behind the scenes putting it together from like this sort of minuscule TV level budget and having to figure out all the ways of delivering that in a way that doesn't have all the advantages of a comic where you can draw anything. So I can imagine that. And then when I want to go over the limits of that, because it's pretty much just a game I'm playing with myself, I can just do that. And I can say, okay, let's have a huge vehicle the size of an aircraft carrier or whatever, and give myself one of those as a treat.
That's like really fascinating to me, because you know the thing that you always hear about comics is that you can do whatever you want. There's no special effects budget. So thinking about it in those terms and using that to sort of get the feel of a movie, that makes so much sense, and it never would have occurred to me.
Well, I mean, when you write X-Men 92, which is very much like the feel of the cartoon, but transposed to a comic.
It is similar to, but legally distinct from the cartoon.
But legally distinct from. Do you imagine a X-Men-like, but legally distinct sort of cartoon in your mind that you then sort of transpose back with all the sort of, I want to say limitations, but it's really just like the characteristics that go with that mode.
For me, no. I think we were maybe thinking about that from the start. And you know, there is, you know, Chad and I being a writing team, we do kind of, we always read the dialogue to each other out loud as we're writing, so to make sure it has that kind of on-purpose awkwardness to it.
Yeah.
But for me, it's the opposite thing. Like, I'm, you know, I've said this in interviews, like, I'm trying to capture the feeling of being, you know, when I was 10 years old and I first started reading the X-Men in the 90s. And I thought that, you know, I loved it, but I knew in my heart I would never read enough comics that I would understand it.
I think the other thing that might be similar is the whole sort of Batman 66 thing, where they're trying to capture the spirit of the show, and they're not really doing anything that exceeds what you do in the show, but they're able to do the best version of it and the biggest and boldest version of it, because it is, at the end of the day, all drawn. So they get to execute as if they have a very good budget and very good luck with it.
Yeah, I mean, there was that first issue of Batman 66 where they had the plane crash. And I was like, yep, that is exactly what a plane crash would have looked like if they had an extra $50,000 on that show.
Yeah, in the actual show, it would probably be some stock footage or a plane noise and people doing some acting, looking up at it.
I love the idea of you envisioning yourself as, like, oh, there's our beleaguered producer, Arthur Wyatt, who has to figure out how to make all this work with the budget.
I mean, I say all this, probably you'll read Dust and you'll see bits and you think, he is cheating like crazy on that. How would they do that?
Oh yeah, I mean, you've got like a, you know, you've got a VTOL in there. You've got these huge. You've got a living dust cloud that gouges people's eyes out. It's still Judge Dredd, I think, is the one I'm getting at.
There's always the face shooting and the eye gouging.
And that, I think, is a great line to move to Twitter questions on. This is the part of the show where we turn over the interview to our listeners on Twitter, Matt. If people want to get in on the interviews that we have each and every week here on War Rocket Ajax, how exactly can they go about that?
Well, there are a few steps in the process. The first step is to just take a lot of cough syrup, like more than the recommended dose, more than seems like should be legal or safe, and then walk out outside the walls of the walled-in city in which you live, into the big, terrifying desert outside. Traverse that dangerous, dangerous landscape. Learn a lot about yourself. Learn about your fears. Then return home and apply for an account. I don't think you have to apply. I think you can just sign up.
No, I don't think you need an invite anymore.
Sign up for an account on twitter.com if you don't already have one. Follow the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, and the ISB, that's Chris. Wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific Time. And we will put out the call for questions for our guest. You can ask one similar to the ones you're about to hear for Arthur Wyatt. Here's the first one for you, Arthur. This is from Focused Totality on Twitter. Alex Mansfield. Alex wants to know, are you freaked out by Dredd fans who don't understand that he's actually the bad guy?
Oh, that is such a good question. I think most people I've met who are fans of Dredd have a certain kind of understanding of the way Dredd works and the way that he's occasionally a heroic figure in the comic, but he's always a villainous figure, and he's always a representative of a future that's pretty horrible and a system that just grinds people down. Occasionally, I guess it's possible to see people who are just like a little bit too into that, and you're thinking maybe you're taking this a bit too far, and you should remember that this is sort of more in, I guess, a sort of warning or as black humor than as a guide to the future social order. I think there's definitely a lot of black humor in British science fiction properties that's kind of like that. You've got to kind of keep on the right side of it. I think Warhammer has a lot of that also. Over in the States, I mean, I think people who are sort of like really into the Punisher, sometimes you wonder if they're maybe a little too far into the Punisher. Everyone here is fine, of course.
I think characterizing Dredd as the bad guy is a little misleading, though.
I mean, he's heroic at times. Like, you know, his first big outing was crossing the cursed earth to save a city as the one guy tough enough to do it.
Yeah, I think referring to him as the bad guy kind of ignores the part where there are, like, interdimensional skeleton monsters who want to kill everyone.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely his best and his most incisive when there is a little bit of social commentary to it as well. And when it's playing up that aspect, he's more often than not, if not the villain, then he's the guy who's sort of executing the will of a bad system and a bit regretful about it.
Listen, Judge Dredd's not a bad guy. He's not a good guy. He's just the guy.
He is the law.
That's right. He's just the law. There you go. This next question comes from Charlotte of Oz on Twitter. Charlotte wants to know, what nation's judges that we haven't seen yet in Dredd are you eager to show in glorious stereotypical fashion?
Oh, gosh. In the movie Dredd? That's an interesting question also. I mean, so far we've pretty much had the city in isolation. So we in comics terms, I guess, haven't gotten up to the sort of Lunar City era where they started bringing in Britsit judges and Sov judges and all of that. You'd probably want to do it in comics order a little. I don't know if we can get away with the Sovs because they're very of an era. And though the movie kind of harkens back to that era, there's definitely a real 80s action movie vibe to it. I don't know if you can just sort of like bung in like Sov judges who probably all look like the bad guys from the Rocky movie. I don't know. I mean, maybe you could get away with that. Maybe we are in a retro future now where we can have Russian bad guys again.
Maybe you just update them all to look like Vladimir Putin. Put them on a horse without a shirt on.
Dredd has to wrestle a bear.
Yeah, there you go.
Listen, I would absolutely read that comic.
We haven't had a bear judge yet, so there's a... And there's a strong 2000 AD tradition of villainous bears, so we could definitely play into that.
I don't think there's ever been a phrase that has sold me harder on 2000 AD than there's a strong tradition of villainous bears.
Oh yeah, I mean Shaco, you've got to check it out. It's great stuff.
Oh yeah, we've talked about it before.
Yes, I may have brought
it up because
you absolutely
I'm big on the bear.
That was the last appearance, I believe. A lot of talk about that bear. The next question is from Lucas Brown. He's Lokified on Twitter. He is the very nice young man who sent us, Chris and I, boxes of Australian snacks.
Oh, that guy rules.
Lucas wants to know, if Cursed Earth Pizza was real, what would you order?
Let me see. Some of those flying rats. So they probably make you fly. Probably some dangerous mushrooms. I don't know. I mean, anything you eat in the cursed earth is probably going to have some kind of weird or toxic effect on you. So I guess it would be about getting a balance of toxins, maybe some cursed earth pineapple to balance out the cursed earth sausage and keep you on a level.
Yeah, you really got to get those flavor balances right.
Yeah.
The next question comes from Peter Swanson. That's PW Swanson on Twitter. And I think that, Arthur, you and Chris are probably going to want to both answer this question. The question is, Dredd wants to kill someone. Batman is protecting him. What happens next?
Oh, who's writing it and whose comic is it in? Because that's gonna be the decider. I mean, in that and any other crossover. Me, I'm a big old wuss. I'm sort of inclined to let Batman win on that one, unless it's someone terrible. So then maybe I'd let Dredd have the day there. Dredd, of course... not a big fan of any kind of vigilante action whatsoever. So he's going to be super pissed at getting stopped from doing any killing there. And there'll be a big old fight.
That's generally how it goes.
It's how crossovers work. It's the magic formula.
I mean, if memory serves, that's pretty much what John Wagner did when he wrote the Batman Judge Dredd crossover.
I think... So I think it was sort of like Batman coming over, chasing someone, I think he just sort of fiddles with the belt and ends up in Mega City 1 and is almost immediately beaten to a pulp by Judge Dredd.
Yep, and that is why when I was like 12 and that was the first Judge Dredd comic I read, I was like, nope, not reading this. Yep. This guy sucks.
Hand to hand, I think Batman's probably got the advantage there, unless... Dredd just straight up shoots him, which kind of tends to end things.
I think any...
You know, I'm gonna, Arthur is a guest on this show. I'm going to let him have this one.
Okay. I just think any Batman-Judge Dredd crossover is lacking if it doesn't have them engaging in some kind of scowl-off. Like, just scowling at each other as hard as they can for at least a minute or two.
Dredd, Batman kind of works a little better than anyone who's sort of more lethal. Like, Batman's all about the non-lethals. He's never going to kind of up his game to that sort of level where Dredd's going to want to just shoot him. If there was like a Punisher Dredd thing, then Dredd's not even going to blink there. That's just going to be a straight up execution.
Our next question comes from _Lexifab on Twitter, Dave Versace. Dave wants to know, which classic Dredd story would you adapt for the hoped-for Carl Urban Netflix series, and he wants to know if it's Midnight Surfer. Now the Dread Comics series have not really been adaptations of previous Judge Dredd stories. They've just been new stories with the movie version of Dredd. If you were going to adapt an older Judge Dredd story to put it in the movie universe, what would it be?
My story, Uprise, was a little bit of my take on sort of a lesser known Dredd classic, but one that's sort of very widely loved, called The Pit, which is, it's basically Dredd takes over at a sector house, has a bunch of awful judges under him that he has to get into shape because this is the worst sector in the city. And he's gonna step up to that managerial level and get them all into shape and then sort of get onto the street and fix things for himself as well. I think I'd probably take that same story and just make that the season arc of a Netflix story. And then there'd be room within that to sort of hit on various Dredd stories for sort of an episode or two along the way. Clearly, I've thought about this way too much.
So you're saying it's not Midnight Surfer?
I think, you know, Chopper's featured as some graffiti in the film, so he would be a great character to have in there, almost a sort of flitting presence in the background. That might be a sort of a just before the finale thing, is you just sort of resolve the Midnight Surfer plot that's been going there all along, and then sort of build up to sort of riots and chaos for your inevitable finale.
Next up, we have a question from Ileana Rasputin, Magic in Kitty 5 Ever on Twitter. They want to know, what's your favorite Garth Ennis Judge Dredd story arc?
Oh, gosh. Garth Ennis on Dredd is kind of an interesting one. He sort of came in very young, and he moved on from John Wagner, who at the time was sort of drifting away from 2000 AD and going over to the magazine and starting that up and starting some other things up with US Comics. So Ennis was kind of the heir apparent. And because of that, in the UK in particular, not all of his stories are just regarded as being quite on the same level as Wagner's. And then he kind of built up a very strong reputation with his US stuff. Looking back on it, though, you know, I think there's some real gems in there. If I had to pick one, I think he did a very good follow-up story to Necropolis that I'm forgetting the name of, that had the chief judge at the time of Necropolis, which was this sort of big Wagner epic where Judge Death takes over the city and has all the judges under his sway and zombifies the chief judge. I think Ennis did a story where the chief judge came back as this sort of rather pitiful semi-zombie creature and pointed out that he was actually never officially deposed and he was still the chief judge. And Dredd and the rest of the judges have to sort of figure out what to do with him. And I remember that being a really strong one when I reread it. I'm also sort of fond of one that he, I think he did basically to persuade 2000 AD to give him the rights to Crisis stuff back. He did this story, Helter Skelter, which is this sort of crazy long form piece of fanfic that just sort of brings every single 2000 AD story crossing over into Dredd's world. And it's kind of uneven, but there's something kind of glorious about it as well. I kind of like that thing. It's almost entirely Carlos Esquerra as well, with a brief interlude of Henry Flint. So it's like really pretty to look at as well.
Well, I think that is going to be our last question. Arthur Wyatt, it was a pleasure to have you on War Rocket Ajax as our guest, as it always is. Before we wrap up, please let all our listeners know the various places that they can find you on the internet.
Okay, so I am on Twitter as Arthur Wyatt. That is pretty much my internet presence at the moment. I really should get that website together. Also, on May 11th, when the latest comic comes out, I should be at Xanadu Comics in Seattle. So if anyone's in Seattle and wants to get something signed, that's a great place to do that.
All right. Our guest has been Arthur Wyatt. He is the writer of Dread Dust. It is out this week, and it is absolutely worth your time to check out if you enjoyed the Dread movie, which of course you did. Everybody liked that movie. It's great. So, Arthur, thank you so much for dropping by. We always like to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you. And thank the listeners as well. That was a really great set of questions.
Thanks once again to Arthur Wyatt for stopping by. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Definitely pick up Dust. It's awesome. But we asked him a lot of questions, and now it is time for me and Matt to answer a few questions sent in by you, the listener.
That's right. These are questions that have come in to our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. The first question we have comes from the Genuflector on Tumblr.
My favorite supervillain.
He wants to know, what are the best Alfred stories?
Ooh, that is a good one. Alfred hasn't had the solo stories that you would think a character of his vintage and of his importance would have had. That's a tough one to pin down. I honestly can't think of a lot of solo Alfred stories.
Well, what would you say are some good Alfred stories that aren't necessarily solo Alfred stories, but stories where Alfred just happens to shine?
Like, Alfred's one of those characters where it's very difficult to get him wrong. So most of his good moments are like when he shows up and just says something, you know, kind of insightful, or you know, my favorite version of Alfred is the, you know, snarky kind of animated series inspired Alfred. And you know, those kind of blend into the background. Like one of my all time favorite Alfred moments is the one during Officer Down, where Batman, you know, Jim Gordon gets shot and Batman kind of like freaks out. And Batman's version of freaking out is that he just kind of stands in Jim Gordon's hotel room, in his hospital room. And he's like, you know, he won't leave. Like, he won't even leave to go, like, track down the person who did it. And Alfred keeps telling him, like, look, you've got to go out there and do this. And Batman says, like, yeah, like, if he doesn't pull through, I'll... And then Alfred goes, you'll what? You'll put on a bat costume and haunt the night for the rest of your life? Which I think is a very, like... That's a really good Alfred line. He's like, yeah, Bruce, you've already kind of done the most extreme thing. Now you need to get out there and keep doing it. The really good Alfred moments are like that. They're very kind of small pieces of the story. I honestly don't know. Like, I don't even know, like, where you would go for an Alfred-centric story, if not to, you know, 1954 and The Outsider, you know?
Yeah, and I honestly feel like a lot of the stories that do sometimes try to focus on Alfred don't capture what we like about Alfred.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like anything where he's like, you know, oh, he used to be in the SAS, or he was a British spy or whatever. That's not really the story I want to read about Alfred. I don't want to read about his history of being a badass.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
See, I do. I think Alfred, like, I kind of admire DC's restraint in not doing it, but I feel like of all the, you know, I said this when Gotham came out. I don't know if you remember that from so long ago, but it's like, if you want to do a story about Gotham City pre-Batman, like, don't do it about Jim Gordon. Like, do it about Alfred. Like, Alfred is a young man. Alfred is, like, you know, an actor turned special agent, because that is his kind of canonical Silver Age backstory. that, you know, has been coming back in drips and drabs over the years. It's a little bit in the Dark Knight trilogy, but only because Michael Caine said it, like, in interviews. So, like, you know, do a story where it's, like, Alfred in the 80s, like, Alfred in the 70s, 80s, you know, 90s even, and he's fighting, you know, he meets Ra's al Ghul. Like, I'd be totally in for that, as long as it's, you know, like... The best thing would be, like, you know, every now and then Thomas Wayne shows up and he's like, ah, I love my family. Martha's pregnant. It's going to be so great. I always wanted to be a dad. Like, do that, I think, and it would be really fun. But yeah, like, I feel like you could very easily do a, like, if not an ongoing, like, the Alfred, you know, the Alfred Pennyworth 4-issue miniseries, I would be completely into. Like, can you imagine getting, like, a... like Tom King and Mikael Janin on that, on the Alfred book? God, that would be awesome.
I mean, that would be awesome, but I don't know that that would be the team that we would get on the Alfred 4-issue origin story. I guess I'm just too worried that they'll screw it up. If I'm going to give an answer for, like, my favorite, one of my favorite Alfred stories, though, it's an animated series episode. It's The Forgotten, which is the animated series episode where Bruce Wayne forgets that he's Batman and gets taken to a work camp. And then Alfred just realizes that he's not around, so he gets in the Batwing and flies into a canyon to try to get Bruce Wayne back.
Yeah, that episode rules and is awesome.
It's so good. And it's has great music.
It's got, oh, that music in that episode, it's so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, like, that's, I think that that stuff's great. Alfred on the animated series is a very, very good. Again, it's a small part, but it's, you know, Ephraim Zimbalist just does, like, the perfect delivery on all those snarky lines. Like, you know, he's a little bit, he does a little bit of the Master Bruce in the first couple of episodes, but once he hits his stride, like pinpoint zingers on Batman.
That time that he draws Batman a bath.
Yes, that one's great. The one where he has a girlfriend who never shows up again. I love her. And, like,
they get dragged into, like, a youth resort thing that turned out to be a scam.
Yeah, it's a weird Poison Ivy plot.
That's right. Right, let's knock out one more question. This is from Grantake, and you can tell that this is an older question, because it starts with, I'm not a pro wrestling fan, but listening to your King of Trios episode, I started wondering...
Okay, so this is from 8 months ago.
That's right. I started wondering, how did pro wrestling become the way it is with all the theatric plots and kayfabe? Did it start out that way? Was it a slow transition from something more like boxing or something else? I think the answer to that question is to read The Squared Circle by David Shoemaker, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
If you have any interest in that at all. But the short version is that wrestling did start out as a shoot sport, but very quickly shoot meaning real in wrestling language, but very quickly became theatrical by virtue of being part of carnivals. And then it became carny showmanship. Like, wrestling emerged from carny stuff, which is why all the language involved in wrestling is also carny language.
Yeah, like,
that's why fans are called marks, exactly.
Yeah, but if you want to know how it became the way it is today, I mean, in all honesty, there is a two-word answer to that, and it's Vince McMahon.
Sure, but the nature of wrestling being worked goes way back beyond before that.
Oh, true. But I'm talking about, like, the level of theatricality, the acknowledgement of it being a story, like, the fact that it is considered to be entertainment, you know, sports entertainment rather than a sporting contest. Like, that's Vince. Like, it's like nobody else was going to do that until Vince came along and he was like, yeah, it's a show. Hey, everybody, it's fake. Like, and he's, you know, it always surprises me. You and I have talked about how we grew up as WCW fans. And for those of you who don't necessarily know, WCW slash National Wrestling Alliance, was always the more, you know, like the old school Southern wrestling. You know, the characters had characters, but, you know, the characters were like, I'm an evil Englishman, or I'm a good guy surfer. Like, they weren't like, I'm an escaped convict, and I'm a model, and I'm a barber who carries garden shears. So, like, it always surprises me when I go back and watch, like, WWF stuff from the 90s, because it's such, like, even when they're treating it as though it is, you know, 100% real, even when they're adhering to kayfabe, like, The Undertaker is there. And they do this one show. I forget which one it was, but it's from, like, 1996. It's very early in Undertaker's run. And it's in the New Generation era, which is what it's called. It's a casket match. I want to say it's Undertaker versus Yokozuna. And they put Undertaker in the casket, and then they wheel him out. And then there's a shot on the Titantron, which is that big TV screen that's above the entrance. And it is a camera that goes, like, that is aimed at the coffin as though it is in a pitch black void. And the camera goes into the coffin, and it, like, it's on the Undertaker laying in the coffin, and he opens his eyes and delivers a spooky monologue while the coffin is, like on the ramp, so you can see it. And they're doing, like, you know, a video that is meant to be coming live from inside the coffin, as though Undertaker has magically taken control of the television. Like, that's showmanship, and that is pure showmanship, and I love it.
Yeah, certainly that level of showmanship is only existed, you know, since Vince McMahon Jr. has been doing stuff. But I think you can also go back to Dusty Rhodes, you can go back to Vince Sr., you can go back to Vern Gagne and see the seeds of that, some of that stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think you can go back to Gorgeous George, and, like, yeah, the characters and the showmanship was always a part of it, but the kind of level of acknowledgement of it, you know, the there are fireworks at the start of a show.
Certainly the acknowledgement of it. I think you can look at an evolution from, okay, it's a carnival show where we have to have instantly identifiable good guys and bad guys, so the audience knows who to root for and who to boo, right? That evolves into, now there's TV, so now we have to have stories and feuds where wrestlers not just have matches, but have reasons to fight each other beyond sporting competition, right?
Right.
And then that eventually evolves into what the WWF is, which is, you know, the soap opera that it has been, I guess since the 1980s.
Yeah, but if you want to learn more about those early days, definitely, like Matt said, The Squared Circle is a really good book for that.
Yeah, Dave Shoemaker knows wrestlers' names from the 1930s that I would never know.
You talking about George Hackenschmidt?
Well, I know George Hackenschmidt. I know, you know, Frank Gotch, and that's about it. Maybe Lou Fez. All right, that I've expended my old wrestling knowledge, so I think it's time to wrap up the listener question segment. Thank you for the questions that came in. Once again, if you would like to send us a question on our Tumblr, you can do so by going to warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. You can also send us questions at our email address, which is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is also where you can send every story ever lists, panel president lists, comments, and if you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know there. Check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can download the show, stream the show, read show notes, and leave comments. Also, check us out on iTunes. If you like the show, go on iTunes and leave us a review. The more positive reviews we get on iTunes, the more we are featured there. And now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. For me, all you have to do is go to about.me/MattDWilson. That is where you will find links to my Tumblr, my Twitter, and my books on Amazon, which will be added to within the next year or so. You can also find my comic Copernicus Jones Robot Detective by going to Comixology and searching for those very words. Chris, where can everybody find all your stuff?
Everybody can find me at about.me/ChrisSims. That's ChrisSims. I'm also the ISB on Twitter and Tumblr. And you can find me in your local comic shop or on Comixology as the co-writer of X-Men 92 coming out from Marvel Comics. Number 3 came out last week, and this is the big turning point of our first story arc. It's a 4-issue story, so this is where things kind of get very serious for your favorite 90s mutants. I'm really proud of how this issue turned out, and it's got a lot of fun stuff in it. This first story... maybe opening with the story where all the X-Men get turned into vampires was a little risky, but I'm super proud of it. I absolutely love it, and it's been getting a lot of good buzz, so please check it out if you haven't already. And yeah, we'll be keeping up with it as we go on. So
it has a Council of Crosstime Draculas, everybody. So.
It does, and I gotta admit, I'll say this here because I have not said it anywhere else. Not only is that Chad's idea, which I have said elsewhere, everybody thinks it's me, that one was Chad's, but also I kind of fought against it. I was worried that if we opened the third issue by going to an interdimensional Dracula castle and introducing the Council of Crosstime Draculas, I was like, yeah, we're definitely gonna lose people on this one. Chad pushed for it, and I agreed with him, and so it was really fun to actually sit down and write the words King Dracula and then have Alti draw exactly the image I had in my head when I wrote King Dracula. So, yeah, Council of Crosstime Dracula's first appearance. Do not miss it. High value. Key book. Tell your store that you want as many copies as they are willing to order. And thank you, everybody, if you already have picked that up. That does it. This has been War Rocket Ajax number 303. Hopefully next week I will be a little less sick. We'll have a good one for you next week, everybody. Have a great week.
Yeah! It's for every one of us. It's not for every one of us. It's not every body, every man, every woman, every child, everybody flash. You know everything to Flash. This day on, at every breed of mongrel.